that the relationships or the countries that Israel has normalized with, like, for example, Egypt, well, isn't that a threat to other countries who has already been normalizing with Israel?
Yes, it's not a threat for countries that have been normalizing. It's a threat for everyone in the region. Yes, for everyone in the region. First of all, it's the main threat is for the countries that are on the borders with Palestine. We're speaking about Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria, because what's happening in Syria today may happen in any country of these of these four countries. So they feel threatened. Number two, all other regional powers also feel threatened. Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Turkey, because they feel that now Israel is moving on towards the goal of being the hegemonic power in the region, which they have no interest in.
At times where the United States still speaking about Abraham Accords, and obviously the Israelis are another dimension
yes,
here.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Maybe that will actually cause some kind of diffusion between the two.
Now,
do you agree to that?
Yes.
Because there are two different perspectives here.
Yes, I agree to that, but you have to see which perspective will win.
Okay.
The American one, which depends on diplomacy, or the Israeli one, which depends on forcing others to normalize.
Okay, the stalemate in the ceasefire negotiations in the Gaza Strip was addressed by the Israeli media, which considers that there are two unresolved issues that are the subject of discussion with the mediators, the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city. Obviously, the two disputed points in the negotiations are the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city inside Rafah specifically. Do you think there is a possibility of resolving them in preparation for concluding the deal?
Well, to be honest, I don't think that in this round of negotiation there will be ability to conclude the deal, because it's obvious that still Hamas and Israel diverge a lot on several points, especially the point about how Israel wants to continue being inside of Gaza. And they want to continue to be there as a part of continuing of the occupation of Gaza, destroying the resistance and everything. So I think the divergence is still a lot between the two parties, so I don't think the current round will lead to a deal. At the same point,
but what happened here to the American pressure for this deal to take place?
You know,
as if
we
kind
have been,
of retaliated.
Yes, no, we have been having 16 rounds.
Yes,
we have been having 16 rounds of negotiations between Israel and Hamas. In the 16 rounds, if you follow up with the official American statements before every round, most of the American official statements say that we are near to reaching an agreement. We have been
very close.
We are very close to reaching the agreement. So it's always what the Americans said. They are always saying we are pressuring Israel, we want to reach an agreement, we are near that, we are close to reaching it, and then they blame Hamas. But
Trump, he speaks unrealistically about it.
Exactly. But the main problem is that Israel is not able to be, or isn't convinced that it has to leave Gaza. And that's mainly because of its colonial history. Israel wants to be occupying Gaza, and it doesn't feel now that it's pressured to the look that it has to leave Gaza.
Yeah.
I think that every day passes on, the military pressure on Israel, the diplomatic, the political one, will increase until they are convinced to reach an agreement.
Okay. We remain with the negotiations, the two issues, the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city. A former Israeli officer told Hebrew media that these two matters are political and their proposal is intended to serve Netanyahu, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. To what extent do you see that the issue of the Murat Corridor and the humanitarian city in Rafah pose a real threat to occupation soldiers who are committing suicide?
Yes, well, I think that you can find the answer in Khan Yunis. You can find the answer in every city inside of Gaza today, where Israeli soldiers are found and already paying the price, and they are already being targeted by the Palestinian resistance. So it's not about expectations, it's about what we're seeing today. So it's obvious today that, yes, Israel can move inside of Gaza. It's obvious also today that Israel can't stay inside stable points inside of Gaza, because there will be a price. And it's obvious that the resistance inside of Gaza, Hamas, is still strong, it still has capabilities, and it can still inflict damage to the Israeli army. And that's the main thing today to understand, is that for almost 2 years of war between Israel and several countries and parties in the region, till now, no strategic goal achieved by Israel. We still have a very strong resistance inside of Gaza, which is leading to giving them the ability to say no in negotiations. If they weren't this strong, then Israel would have
instead,
been
instead, the number of soldiers being killed is on the rise.
Exactly.
Israeli soldiers.
Because every day that passes on, the resistance will adapt more to the type of war they are facing, number one. And number two, it's because Israel is facing a resistance. So if one person is still alive and has weapons, he will fight. So and let's not forget that Palestinians are the one who own the land. So they will never leave their lands and give it to Israel. So all the situation is not with the benefit of Israel, and we are seeing them today. So I think the Murak corridor, the humanitarian city, is not applicable. And the answer for that you can find in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, and many other cities inside of Gaza, where Israel soldiers are being killed and are being targeted by the Palestinian resistance.
Mm-hmm. And when actually the Israeli side insists on the Murak corridor and on the humanitarian city in Rafah, doesn't that tell us that they're putting their soldiers at very high risk? And wouldn't that damage the relationship between the army and the political side?
Well, I do believe that the relationship is already damaged, but you know, the army at the end of the world has to abide by the rules.
Mistrust.
Yes, there's mistrust. Of course, they don't believe that Netanyahu is following Israel's interests. Of course, the army is too tired. Of course, the army is paying a huge price for staying in war for almost 2 years. And this is what they have been saying to Netanyahu for the past several months. But at the end of the world, Netanyahu is forcing others to follow by what he views best, and that's what's mainly inflicting affecting the trust between him and other people inside of Israel.
In addition to threats from some far-right ministers to withdraw from the Israeli government if a ceasefire agreement is reached, there were also threats from ministers of the religious parties to resign from Netanyahu's government if the Haredi draft crisis is not resolved. To what extent do you think that there is a real possibility for the Shaz party members, as we highlighted in this report, has been highlighted in the report, to resign from the government if members of the United Torah Judaism party resign over the Haredi draft crisis?
Well, I think, yes, Israel faces a huge problem today regarding the Haredi crisis. And, you know, it's more deep than only the Haredi crisis. It's about trust between Netanyahu and different factions inside of Israel. So it's about between him and the liberals, between him and the Haredi, between him and the army, between him and other political parties. So there is really a political division inside of Israel, which is escalating throughout time. And this may lead nearly to a point where, yes, Chas may resign and other political parties may resign. And it's ironic that, you know who are the Haredis? They are the most religious people inside of Israel. Okay. So the most religious people inside of Israel are being divided because of what? Because they don't believe that the army is a suitable place for them to be inside. They don't believe in defending Israel. They believe that the others should defend Israel, not them. These are the most religious people inside of Israel that don't believe that they should take part in defending Israel. And they also promote that the army is not suitable for religious people. So this is how much divided Israel is today.
Okay, and how would that develop in the coming days if this division continues?
Well, I
because
always
obviously they are, every now and then when we get close to a ceasefire, they threaten to
yes, they used to threaten
to retire. Yes.
They used to threaten that before based on how they view the war. Now they feel that they are threatened. It's not about soldiers being threatened. It's not about Israel's interests. It's about their own interests. That's why I always say Israel in the future, everyone is writing, everyone is speaking about it facing more strategic failures. One of them is this division.
Okay, the Israeli commentator actually mentions a deadline of just 2 days for religious parties to withdraw from the government if Netanyahu does not find a solution to the Haredi draft issue. Do you think that is possible?
Yes, I do think that's possible because they won't give Netanyahu the chance to negotiate with them, try to pass the laws he is trying to pass, that they think that they affect them negatively. Mm-hmm. So at the point where they find that there's no deal that can be achieved, and Netanyahu is insisting on continuing with the Haredi
project. What would happen then to Netanyahu's government?
Well, it depends on how much people resign from the government, and it depends on how much he can convince other parties to fill the blank place inside of the government. So, I think if the Haredi do resign, then Netanyahu will surely have a huge problem inside the cabinet, and I think that he will then go towards early elections, But you know, the problem inside of Israel is even today.
Yes, a lot are speaking about early elections and how yes. he's very interested in that.
Yes, because all the surveys show that if early elections happen today, then he will return as being the prime minister of Israel. Mm-hmm. So, but the problem with Netanyahu is even if he returned being prime minister, and I think that early elections is one of the most possible scenarios today. The problem is that his coalition won't be stable. It's always him with others, and he needs others for the whole coalition to form a cabinet. And his views with the other parties' views are diverging a lot, with the Haredis, with the liberals, with the opposition parties, and everything. So it's always Israel's political parties, political cabinet, will always be divided, and that's the most important thing to concentrate on.
Okay. Israeli social media reacted to the rising death toll among the occupation soldiers in the Gaza Strip and strongly criticized the Netanyahu government's attempts to appease the Haredim by exempting them from military service. Here are some of the comments.
Sagit Abu, in the Knesset, we knew about the deaths of the three soldiers in Gaza. Nevertheless, we witnessed the shameless begging by the governing coalition toward the Haredim to stay in the government after promising not to pass the Haredi draft law for the army. Yuzi Shoham, if opposition leaders come to power, they'll give the Haredim every budget they want in exchange for votes. No one will object then, because drafting the Haredim was never the opposition's goal. The goal has always been, and still is, to bring down the coalition. Hantri Stanit, while the country bleeds, the governing coalition plays its political game. That is how this government operates.
Dr. Mohammed Suwaydan, academic and writer in international affairs, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
Destroying everything, everything that's dear to me. I can never be like you. You are the wicked of this world. You are the reason why we feel fear in our daily lives. Not about killing, it's about life and sharing. Laugh with someone. Yes, faith is not about killing, it's about life and sharing. Life and making a difference. Yeah, making a difference. Don't involve. Yeah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials and the ambassadors of Muslim countries. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on March 31, 2025. Today, events around the world are taking place in rapid succession at a staggering pace, whether in our region or in other parts of the world. This rapid pace at which events are taking place necessitates that all those who see themselves as being either influential or affected by these global events keep up with these events quickly and carefully and state their position. Today, Islamic governments have this duty. Islamic governments should think carefully about their own nations, their friends, their enemies, and the events that lie ahead and await them. The Islamic world is quite large. We Muslims have a large population. We are situated in a critical geographical location in the world, and in terms of the world's natural wealth, we rank among the wealthiest countries and communities in the world. If the Islamic world wants to take advantage of these critical situations, it needs to take a fundamental action: unity, the unity of the Islamic world. Unity doesn't mean that governments should merge together into a single entity. It doesn't imply that they must think alike in all political orientations. The unity of the Islamic world involves, first and foremost, recognizing common interests. In the first step, they need to know what their common interests are. We shouldn't define our interests in a way that would lead to discord, conflict, and strife among ourselves. The Islamic world is one family. It's one whole. Islamic governments must think about this and move in this direction. The Islamic Republic has extended its hand toward all Islamic governments and considers itself to be their brother. As the president just stated, it considers itself to be with them in one general fundamental front. Let's work together and put our minds together. Let's maintain unity in the Islamic world. If we do this, the aggressive, oppressive, coercive powers won't be able to attack the Islamic world, impose their will, or blackmail them. Unfortunately, extortion and blackmail have become the common practices of the powers today. Major powers blackmail weaker countries, governments, and nations, and they state this openly. Let's not allow the Islamic world to be blackmailed by the US and the likes of them. We must defend the rights of the oppressed. Today, part of the Islamic world is severely wounded. Palestine is wounded. Lebanon is wounded.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. Stop.
about you. Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year. And the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. And now we'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with To My Brother. The program examines the universal principles contained in the teachings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and their importance for contemporary individuals and societies. Next up will be Spotlight. This is our final program this hour. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam treated all human beings to be equal in the matter of rights and responsibilities, and he did not fix any limit in this behalf of equality among all human beings. And if he did fix any such limits, it was fixed keeping in mind the interests of the public in general, the people. And when we study the character of Imam Ali, we clearly see that he did not violate this freedom, the freedom of the people, the freedom of the public, the freedom in any of his laws, orders, rules, or regulations. And he always kept the public welfare in his view, in all his actions. He dealt equal treatment to both his friends and his foes.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: أقيلوا ذوي المروءات عثراتهم، فما يعثر منهم عاثر إلا ويد الله بيده يرفعه.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Forgive the shortcomings of considerate people, because when they fall into error, Allah raises them up."
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So we're talking about the universal persona of His Eminence. We find that one of the very beautiful nicknames of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam is Al-Sharif, the Honorable One, the Noble One. And so we find, of course, that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most honorable when it comes to lineage, but also when it comes to his ideals, his values, his abstinence from violating the Almighty Allah's prohibitions, his piety, his zuhud, his asceticism, his irfan, his gnosis, his inner knowledge of the realities, and of course being the perfect disciple and the most perfect miracle of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Even the enemies of Imam Ali alayhi salam testified to this honorableness of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It is related that when the army of the Abbasid Khulafa besieged Marwan, the last of the Umayyad rulers, Marwan said to one of his viziers that this army needs Ali alayhi salam. So objecting to this statement, saying that, you know, what does this have and to do with anything, the vizier asked, "How come Ali alone is an army?" Marwan then explained, "You have not understood what I meant. I mean that they need Imam Ali's honorableness and nobility. If these Abbasid Khulafa and their army seizes us, they will annihilate our women, children, and old people. They will leave no single one of us alive. If Ali were the commander of that army, he would never do such things to us, because his honor and nobility would prevent him from doing so." How incredibly beautiful this statement. You know, the Umayyads, of course, were the killers of Imam Ali alayhi salam. They were the usurpers of the position of the caliphate of the divinely appointed imams, peace and blessings upon them all. And here the enemies talk about the honorableness and the nobility and the honor and the sharaf of Imam Ali alayhi salam, even though His Eminence has passed away, you know, and he's no longer present. And it's amazing, after 1,000 years, you know, we too still speak about Imam Ali alayhi salam, his honor and his nobility on the battlefield and off the battlefield. In both aspects of his life, His Eminence was truly honorable. You know, as the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam say, honor does not merely come from an individual's ancestry and heritage. Their personality, their behaviors, their manners, their ethics, their morals, these also bring about honor for an individual. And so we, you know, of course, we too need to be searching for honor and nobility in our behaviors, in our morals, in our ethics, in our speaking, in our, you know, interactions with the people around us, with the people at home. All of these things should reflect this honorableness and this dignity that we have as human beings, and as we have as Muslims, and of course as the Shias of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so this being, having sharaf, having honor, having dignity, is something that we can never forget. Truly a beautiful lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء قدير.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
There are many, many narrations in the Sunni tafasir and books of hadith, including Bukhari and Muslim. And one of the famous narrations which have been repeated many times in these books is from Abdullah ibn Abbas, where he says this happened on a Friday at the time of the khutbah. وَبَقِيَ فِي الْمَسْجِدِ إِسْنَ عَشَرَ رَجُلًا وَالسَّبْعَ نِسْوَةً. According to Abdullah ibn Abbas, only 12 men and 7 women remained. There must have been a big number of the Sahaba there to listen to Rasulullah. Don't tell me, you know, it was not Baitul Qaim, New Jersey, and Mawlana Rizvi speaking. No. It is Masjid al-Nabi, it is Rasulullah, and it's Namaz al-Jumah, which is wajib when Rasul is there. So it must have been a big number there. But according to Abdullah ibn Abbas, only 12 men and 7 women were remaining there. فَقَالَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ لَوْ خَرَجُ كُلُّهُمْ لَفْتَرَّمَ الْمَسْجِدَ عَلَيْهِمْ نَارًا. If all of them would have left, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have sent fire down. And so this is the severity of, you know, condemnation, I would say, or admonishment from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for abandoning the khutbah of Rasulullah in Namaz-e-Jumah. Another ayat of the same kind. You know, before using these, you know, harsh khutbah of Amir al-Mu'mineen to criticize Shias, that he is condemning Shias, you know, look at the Quran. This is from Surah Ali Imran, ayat number 53, about Uhud, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, remember, is tus'iduna wa la talawna ala ahadin wal rasoolu yadu'ukum fi ukhraakum. Remember what happened in the battle of Uhud? You started running away. You didn't even look back to see anyone. While the Rasul at the back was calling you, come back, come back. This is admonition from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And yet you are saying, because they were sahaba, Even though this happened and Allah was disappointed, still they are all of them are udul and adil and just. And so for us, it doesn't make it, it's not a big deal. If our Imam, as a sincere leader and a loving father of the community, sometimes admonishes his followers so that they can become better Shia and better Muslim.
For listening to this episode of the program To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And while the Israeli regime has been successful in its many years of occupation and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and their homeland behind U.S. and European political and military cover, there are emerging dynamics now challenging the status quo. Ongoing Gaza genocide has impelled more and more states, organizations, and bodies to find ways to restrain Tel Aviv's barbarism against Palestinians and its reckless adventurism throughout West Asia. From the ICC this week refusing to revoke arrest warrants for Israeli leadership to an Irish boycott bill of Israeli settler products dubbed the Occupied Territories Bill, and Slovenia barring two Israeli ministers in the current cabinet from ever visiting the country. And these small but highly significant mechanisms of restraint and a few more, the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Paul Lurie, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California in the States. And Mr. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Gentlemen.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I think this is the first time I have Paul, both you and Sayed, at the same time. It's a pleasure. Hope both of you are doing well in your respective neighborhoods there. I guess, Paul, we'll start with you. It's been a while since I've checked in with you. Hope you're doing well in Northern California. When we see the U.S. And most European countries showing no sense of urgency in addressing the Gaza genocide, Paul, how important is it that these other balls start rolling?
What do you mean, no sense of urgency? The United States is urgently sending all the weapons and taking them from Ukraine to Israel. They urgently want to support the genocide in Gaza by every means necessary. I call that urgent. I think you meant something else, but
no, that was well put.
Clearly,
Paul, but basically these small movements and avenues of restraint, how significant do you see them being? We know that they don't stand up to U.S. vetoes. We know they don't stand up to all the lobbying in Europe and also in the States. But there has to be some silver lining. What is it?
Well, as you know, the United States Congress is in the complete control, at least on this issue and actually on several other issues as well. By the Israel lobby, AIPAC, but it's also other organizations that have a stranglehold on our more than just the Congress. Actually, it's a great part of government. So the people, there have been efforts by groups in the United States and individuals, massive numbers of individuals have individually written to members of Congress and the government and demonstrated and written articles, and it's been the subject of social media and all this sort of thing. It's very clear that the majority of the American public, despite all the propaganda to the contrary, is opposed to this war. But the government goes ahead because the government knows that if someone who is opposed to the genocide in Gaza gets into an official role in the U.S. government, the lobby, Zionist lobby will destroy them and take them out and find somebody to replace them. So this is the problem that we face. In the United States, I would have to say the efforts are worth doing, but but they're not as effective as the efforts that you cited that are taking place in other countries.
All right, fair enough. Thank you for your initial thoughts, sir. Paul Saeb, Mohsen Abbas, welcome. Thank you for your patience. And your initial take, please, as well, on these growing mechanisms of restraint, Saeb, and how significant you see them, if at all effective, in further ostracizing Israel.
Well, first of all, I think it's a miracle that we've got to the stage where finally, after 2 years of genocide, we have nations who are beginning to speak up about very basic issues. And I think the kind of things that I picked up were, pledging to cut the military ties, the idea of also putting sanctions, some sort of economic sanctions, trade, cutting diplomatic ties. These are all things actually which the UN rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, was very, very keen on. And she also pointed to the EU particularly failing from her point of view because they have doubled the size of trade relations with Israel. They actually are their top trading partner, as it were. And that, simply the fact that they even, the EU even, are even beginning to talk about some kind of suspension of economic ties, it's a miracle, and it's not really enough, of course. She's saying, well, suspend the entire association agreement, which, according to international law, you're obliged to do under the circumstances. But, of course, the EU and the US and all those Zionist imperialist regimes don't really want to do any of this. It's just that now it's almost probably becoming so untenable within their own populations who are having a meltdown about the way Zionists basically control Western governments that it's almost becoming embarrassing for these politicians, and they've got to be seen to be doing something. The Hague Group, of course, are probably better than most, and those eight countries, there's a chance that we're going to get these embargoes going and some sort of sanctions scenario. Because as the Colombian vice minister said during the talks in Bogota, he said that what's gone on in Gaza is an affront to international order. I'd say it's an affront to civilization and humanity, frankly.
Okay, now I'm glad you brought up Bogota there, Saeb. Paul, the UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, Francesca Albanese, recently the first to be directly sanctioned for her work to address the Gaza genocide, fight for Palestinian rights by the Trump administration. She made her way down there to Bogota to attend this the Hague Group conference consisting of 12 countries. She was able to get a consensus. She had everybody calling it a genocide, which is huge. And consequently, the 12 countries agreed to bar any arms sales to Israel. What kind of victory do you see this as?
It's a victory. But I think some of the other things that they discussed, such as actually sending forcibly food into Gaza with troops that will not accept to be turned away. It was brought up, but that's probably the only thing that is going to be effective, or something like it. Basically, Israel has to feel real pain in order to desist in its crimes against Gaza and against Palestine. Otherwise, they are going to say, "We can wait it out. That's okay. We don't need trade with this country or that country, or we can manage without it. We can get everything we need from our partners, especially the United States, which will get the supplies that we need and figure a way to do this." So, it's good. It's a very good start. It's encouraging, but there have been lots of encouraging signs since October 7th, almost 2 years ago. Mm. So I don't know. I'm not holding my breath on this.
Thank you. And Saeb, the International Criminal Court said it will not revoke arrest warrants that it issued for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and ex-war minister there, Yoav Gallant. And also this week, a U.S. court also said the Trump administration is sanctioning the three ICC judges and their boss, chief prosecutor there, Karim Khan, who issued these warrants, that it's dead wrong, that there's no legal standing for it. How do you gauge another small victory here with respect to the ICC, Sayed?
Well, I think it's definitely, again, a step in the right direction. If the ICC or the ICJ have any credibility as international legal entities, Netanyahu and all those involved in genocide should be arrested in any country they land in, to be fair. That's the compliance that should happen. They should be handed over to the courts, and the courts should deal with them according to the evidence that's already been presented and the tons of evidence that's been accumulated since that ruling, which has been ages. Most people say the ICC, the ICJ, the UN, frankly, they've all failed. They haven't done nearly enough. They've not really participated in synchronizing any kind of real legal punishments on Israel. They've not been boycotted. They've not been banned from any international bodies. They're still members of the UN. They're still members of all of these other institutions. I mean, Russia, by comparison, was hammered very quickly, you know, sanctions and the lot, really, you know. So to be honest, it's not good enough, but something is better than nothing. What to really be happening, of course, is that Israel should be boycotted in every way, shape or form. There should be no diplomatic relations with them. And the real way forward, ultimately, has been shown by the Yemenis. And I'm hardline on this, but you go and look at Eilat Port today, and Eilat Port is now bankrupt. It's declared bankruptcy. 90%, maybe even 100% of its trade is now completely shut down. And that was because the Yemenis made it clear that nothing was going to go through the Bab el-Mandeb to Eilat Port. So Israel wasn't going to get its domestic supplies. And I think that showed how quickly, just Yemen on its own, how badly it hit Israeli trade, and the economic impact of that would have been huge had it not been for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan creating another trade route via, you know, the sea and land to continue the trade supplies which Israel needed. And of course, the US and the British, particularly the Germans as well, have been flying in weapons consignments on a regular basis, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of military items and hardware. And quite frankly, all of this, I can't see how this lifeline and this murder line, this kind of killer line, is going to be stopped, because Britain and the US are still committed to supporting Israel. And this is the crux of the issue. Everybody wants to put plasters, and we're all supposed to be really grateful that anything happens. But the reality of the matter is that Israel itself is a rogue entity. It's an illegal entity. It's a colonialist project which is occupying a land that belongs to another people, and it shouldn't exist. That's the reality of the matter. The whole world ought to not just be begging for Israel to be sanctioned with a few little arms embargoes here and there. What they should be saying is, how on earth do we sort out this rogue nation, which has nuclear weapons at its disposal, and psychopaths in control of them? I mean, how on earth does anybody sit comfortably knowing that Netanyahu and his band of psychopaths, who basically don't think genocide is anything of a problem, have nuclear weapons, and they're willing to bomb at least five or six countries at any one time around them, causing chaos and mayhem, which will potentially all affect the whole of the region. I think far stronger measures have to be taken, and the world needs to wake up, and it needs China and Russia and the big boys to get involved as well. It can't just be these kinds of nations who are sort of relatively lightweight.
Very well put there, Sayed. And Paul, how do you see, how do you gauge the ICC's defiance in standing up for the Palestinians here? And this is a U.S. judge siding with the ICC and standing bold-faced in front of the Trump administration when it comes to not reinforcing these sanctions against ICC judges.
How do I see an exercise of integrity? I see it as normal. I see it as the way it should be. And for us to consider it extraordinary to have this display of normal judicial integrity is a telling sign that we don't expect it. We don't expect integrity in our judicial system, neither the global system nor in our domestic systems either. And the same holds true for enforcement of any of the international laws, including the Genocide Convention, which, of course, the representatives of the fledgling nation of Israel were instrumental in creating, and they welcomed, and now they are the worst offenders of the Genocide Convention, and the rest of the world, under the Genocide Convention, which basically all of them signed, with some exceptions, they are not doing, they're not following their obligations under the Genocide Conventions to stop all support and to practice all, enforcement measures in order to prevent and stop genocide wherever it appears. What happened to all of that? It's a farce. It's clear that in today's world, if not since the beginning of time, that might makes right. And if enough nations are willing, like the Hague Group, for example, that's not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily enough, but it doesn't take a large number of nations to say, hey, let's all get together and send our armies and our cargo ships to Gaza and dare Israel to hit us. Well, yeah, if it's just one or two, and if it's and depending on who they are, it might not be effective. But if you get enough who already have shown that they are enforcing restrictions on Israeli trade and international travel and diplomacy and so forth, if you get enough of them together, it can happen. They can actually, the kinds of things that Israel is doing now to kind of coerce the United States into doing its work, such as the strike against Iran. If other nations will do just the opposite and basically coerce the international community into doing something to defend Palestine and Gaza and international law, then it might be possible, but you have to have a critical mass to do that.
Interesting points there. Thank you, Paul. And Sayed, just this week, there was quite a significant setback. European Union was on the cusp, it seemed so, very close to pushing through punitive measures against Israel, but with some heavy Zionist lobbying of the foreign minister flying in, and who knows what went beyond the scenes, they put it off. Nevertheless, Spanish Prime Minister was irate. He's calling events in Gaza genocide. Ireland is passing legislation to bar any products from the occupied West Bank from reaching Irish soil. And this is to America's chagrin, which is relatively significant, I believe. And Slovenia has declared Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bilal Smotrich, to your point, a couple of psychopaths in this super extreme far-right cabinet, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose persona non grata.